Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with actors Jeremy Webb and Alan McCullough, Frost Nixon, respectively, about the production of the same name show at the TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. Award-winning actor and playwright Dan Hoyle and director Charlie Varon stop by to talk about Dan's new show, Border People. I'll talk with actress Heather Orth, who plays Mrs. Lovett in Hill Barnes' production of Stephen Sondheim's musical thriller, Sweeney Todd. Plus, a talk with directors Wendy Ryan, Ryan T. Smith, and Katie Wong from Raw Dance about the world premiere of Roar, set to an original score by Bay Area composer Joel St. Julian, as part of the company's 15th anniversary home season at the Yerba Buena Center here in San Francisco. Stay with us. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the open airwaves, Dan Hoyle. Dan's latest show is based on conversations and interviews along the southwestern border and into Mexico, as well as refugee safe houses on the northern border with Canada and in courtyards of housing projects in the South Bronx, and is called Border People. It's a timely production for these times. Dan, welcome back to Open Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
He's joined by someone who is credited as not only director but co-developer of the show, Charlie Varon. Charlie is artist in residence at the Marsh Theater as a playwright and performer. Charlie's collaborated with David Ford, also the legendary worker bee of the Marsh, to create award-winning shows that have had long runs both at the Marsh and toured the country. Dan's shows Each and Everything from 2014, The Real Americans in 2010, Things They Happen in 2007, and Florida 2004, The Big Bummer, all of which have received critical acclaim both here and elsewhere, with accolades from Salon, The New Yorker, and The New York Times as well. This one sure to have, yet again, some wonderful press. And we hope some interest from our listening audience as well, Dan. I understand that the inspirational figure that ignited your creative spark for this show was none other than our current commander in Tweet.
Yeah, so I got commissioned to write a new piece when I was still living in New York, and I was an artist in residence at Columbia University's Heyman Center for Humanities, and I didn't know what I was going to write about. And then Trump got elected. And 5 days
and
later,
you're rich with material.
Yeah. So clearly, I mean, I feel like all artists had to do something to respond to that. You know, it's such a huge event. And part of what I have been sort of monitoring is this sort of growing sort of tribalism in our culture and politics. And clearly, Trump doubled down on that and took it to victory. And it was. I want to show people and folks who didn't fit sort of hard definitions and weren't on one side or the other. People who cross borders, both geographical and literal, and also metaphorical. This was what I was sort of thinking. Big idea. And then 5 days after the election, I met this guy who was living in the projects in the South Bronx, close to where we were. But he grew up in an upper middle class suburb of Jersey, and his whole life had basically been toggling back and forth between these two identities. And he had this incredible story. You know, he basically splits the difference now. He's like, so, you know, Long story short, I dress in business casual now, you know, sweater vests, khakis, you know, but to balance out, you know, I also wear Jordans or LeBrons. I'm like the Black Rick Santorum, but, you know, with a look. And so I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, this guy embodies so much of that. And then I started finding more and more people like that. And I went, as you said, to the northern border and the southern border.
Well, tell us a little bit about that field research and how you went about it.
Sure. So I got really interested in these refugee safe houses. It's like, wait, oh, there's people whose immigration status is insecure and they're being housed in these kind of big nonprofits along the northern border because they're trying to flee to Canada. There's a lot of them in Buffalo, New York, which is sort of one of the big cities right across the border. So I went up there and... pretty soon I'm in this lobby of this big place, and I'm meeting this guy, and he's saying he had this very sort of cool haircut, and he was very young, and he says, "Yeah, this is my prom haircut. It's like my cool Brooklyn hipster cut. Yeah, I was at prom 2 weeks ago in Bucks County, drinking Red Bull and vodka in the back of my friend's big truck." It's one of those schools that's so preppy that the school has to bring in a couple hick kids to be authentic, and those kids are poor, so their parents spend all their money on big trucks, and everyone sits in the back and pretends they're hicks too. But not me. I'm from Kabul. That's a pretty big city. Yeah, I was the cute speech and debate kid from Afghanistan, so everyone was cool with me. You know, I'm Muslim, but I stay eating my ham and bacon for breakfast. And nobody where I lived cared about religion growing up. You know, if you're educated, you don't listen to that hardline stuff. Except Mike Pence. But I think he's part robot. And so I just met all these different interesting folks and started working with Charlie. And the first challenge was like, okay, how do we make this?
I was going to say, sort of, you've got such rich volume of source material. Let's back up a minute, though, before that. I imagine a lot of what became your source material was observational. But then how did you get people to open up to you? You say, hey, let's go grab a beer, or did you just like seduce them otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's different situations. So like in the Bronx, I was hanging out in this courtyard, which is kind of, you know, in the housing projects, the Andrew Jackson Homes, one of the big sort of towers projects in the South Bronx, which is kind of a border between, you know, a border within our own country that most people don't ever cross, you know. So there it took a while to sort of be like, hey, you know, this is what I'm doing. First when, you know, people saw me, they say, you know, they're saying the cops is looking at you. Yeah. 'Cause you crossed over that line. You came into the projects. There's no law against it, but they're thinking either you're buying drugs or you're a cop and they ain't ever seen you before. You know, so it was, I had to prove myself,
right.
in that amazing process of sort of building up trust. And now, you know, Larry, he's a friend, you know, and every time I go back, now we left, but for a long time we were living there, and I'd go up there, you know, every week in the afternoons and hang out. So that's one type of thing. And then if I'm going down into, you know, I went to the southern border, with Mexico on a road trip, and, you know, I was going to deported migrant shelters. I was talking to ranchers. Sometimes, though, I'm driving along a deserted road highway, and I get pulled over. And, this Border Patrol guy says, good afternoon, sir. Do you know why I pulled you over? Okay. You were doing over 11 miles per hour of the posted limit. Is this your vehicle, sir?
Wow.
Okay. And what's your purpose of travel? Okay, You're an actor and you're writing a play? Okay. Do you have financial support for this, sir? You know, and it became this whole amazing thing where he was actually really interested in theater and, like, comedy.
And it sounds like he became a character.
He did, yeah.
So did you, the bulk of the material that you assembled then journaled, written, or did you also record interviews as you went along?
Yeah, I do a lot of audio recording, just audio. And I'm always sort of very transparent of, hey, I'm doing this play. I'm an actor and a playwright. You know, I'm gathering people's stories. And, you know, so often people people are like, well, yeah, I want to be heard. And then I sort of bring it all back and I start creating these characters that are based on, you know, these interactions and people I've met, and start working them up and then bring them into rehearsal with Charlie.
Right. So you have this tremendous amount of source material, Charlie Verrin, and you are trying to create now a through line and a show out of it all. Charlie, tell us how you, obviously we're also inspired by the, you know, earth-shaking events of 2016 to make this work happen. When you're presented with the work that Dan comes to you and piles up on your desk or starts to babble about, how do you start making a show out of it?
Well, we start looking for where the, you know, what's most alive, what's most energized, and also what feels most true to the moment that we're living in. And really, early in the process, I felt refreshed. I mean, we're living in a time. In a way, working with Dan on this show woke me up to how shrill, how vituperative the discourse on everything, including immigration and borders, has become, and how we're all sort of swimming in this very almost militarized kind of discourse. And Dan's characters...
And discord, should I say.
Huh? Yeah, and Dan's characters are living their lives... crossing borders. There's a Honduran guy that Dan met in Mexico who had been an incredible story, which Dan performs completely in Spanish. And then we have titles to translate it. But it's like, oh, this is nothing like what we're hearing about. This is lived experience. Often people struggling in all kinds of ways. And there's this huge range of humanity that Dan has... come into contact with in the process of his research. He calls it the journalism of hanging out. And you get to a different level with people. I mean, Dan takes the time to build relationships. It's a different kind of journalism. And then he brings them back, and we sculpt the work and try to make it as, you know, stage-worthy as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also, it's as though you're in the presence of these 11 folks that we're putting in on stage and marinating in their lives, their choices, their dilemmas, and often their extraordinary resilience. There's this incredible human spirit that shines through these characters.
So are we talking more about a pastiche of these characters or a through line for the show?
Yeah, this one is different. It's just 11 monologues, and we sort of did the first night, and we thought, okay, now we need to figure out how it all connects. And it's like, no, people get it, and by taking myself out, it kind of lets these different voices kind of bounce off each other, and the connections are really exciting, you know. So you're going from the South Bronx, this guy who's trying to figure out his identity between the suburbs and now living in the projects, and then you're in, you know, this guy, holy moly, bro, I don't have country. Some people ask me, how is this no country you belong? Because in Saudi Arabia, they say I'm refugee, even though I born there. Because my father, he was from Palestine, he ran in 48, so to them, his kids, we are still refugees. He's a stateless... refugee who left Saudi Arabia because he was persecuted for not being enough Muslim, for not praying. You know, the guys with the big beards, holy moly, Islamic police, those guys, scary guys, man. They're persecuting him. He comes to the U.S. with his family on a tourist visa, fleeing, essentially. He's doing fine, you know. At first, I start one restaurant. I know vision, I know mission, I know plan, but I don't know how to make nice dining atmosphere in Victorville. But you know, problem. Even if you make nice dining atmosphere in Victorville, everybody going to Pollo Loco. You know, so it's like a sort of has a real. All these characters have a tremendous self awareness and sense of themselves and history, and they're funny. So it's just like really fun to invite audiences in to be like, here, I had these amazing experiences. These people open themselves up in this way. Like, I want to give you that as much as possible. And the best way to do that is just to get out of the way myself.
Mm. Interesting how there's no talk about a border wall on the northern border. Slightly porous, shall we say?
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about more of your encounters on the northern border with folks.
Yeah, so I also, there's a woman, this Iraqi American refugee who, was telling me, she said, I lived in Boston for 4 years. I didn't make any friends. But when I came to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, I made a lot of friends. At first, I don't know why, but then I see Amish people, and I think, okay, I may have hijab, but at least I have cell phone and refrigerator. I'm not the weirdest one. And I met her in a park, just hanging out. Then I went back and, developed more relationship with her. And, in Iraq was a professor of American literature, her first true love. And so the people's stories, refugees are amazing. They're like sort of the most Americans around, they're sort of like 1950s Eisenhower, like hardworking, entrepreneurial, religious faith, family oriented. I mean, they are sort of that prototypical. And then in the southern border, I knew I wanted to talk to a rancher. But most of the ranchers you kind of see in the news, it's like they're kind of really hard line and so on and so forth. And I was reaching out to these Arizona Cattlemen Growers Association and getting stonewalled and stuff like that. But I show up at a gas station down by the border and I ask, I'm looking for ranchers. Oh, yeah, I know somebody who's a rancher. I call the guy up. Yeah, come on out. Okay. And I get out there and it's a goat ranch of 20 goats. He's saying, yeah, goats. And we get about 8 inches of rain a year in southern Arizona, Dan. I'm trying to get completely self-sufficient on that, but it's hard. You get more water than you think. You just got to slow it down. You got to trap it. You got to stop it. Yeah. And he's this sort of amazing survivalist guy out there who then has stories about interacting with migrants and then has this whole incredible, his own sort of borders that he crosses in his life and sort of his true story that he reveals about how he's living out there. It's a lot of fun to be able to do. It's a tremendous amount of work, hours and hours and hours. And we're just really excited now that the show is really honed and audiences are really responding.
Catch Dan Hoyle's unique journalistic approach to theater and border people at the Marsh. Co-developed and directed by Charlie Varon. It runs through the 23rd of February. Thursdays and Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 5 at The Marsh on Valencia Street, themarsh.org, for more information. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask about your dad. How is the legendary Jeff Hoyle?
He's doing well. He's working on a new piece as we speak, in between being a granddad to mine and my sister's kids. So, yeah.
Nice. Well, Dan, thanks again for coming in. We look forward to seeing the show. And Charlie, your work, as always, is a pleasure to talk about.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Well, from the demonic occupant of the White House, we turn to a demonic denizen of Fleet Street next on Open Air.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd. He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod. Did Sweeney Todd, a demon barber of Fleet Street. He kept a shop in London town of fancy clients and good renown. And what if none of their souls were saved? They went to their maker impeccably shaved. By Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
He Hill Barn Theater, the peninsula's premier theater company, announced that the Demon Barber of Fleet Street will terrorize the streets of Foster City, this just in, with Stephen Sondheim and Hugh Wheeler's musical thriller Sweeney Todd opening tonight. Sweeney Todd has become a bloody worldwide success since being awarded 8 Tony Awards, including Best Musical for its Broadway premiere back in 1979, which I, as a high schooler, had the privilege to attend, coming down from my little high school in Connecticut. This theatrical treat has shocked, awed, and delighted audiences across the world. I'll talk about some of those adaptations and subsequent productions with my guest, Heather Orth, who plays the iconic role of Mrs. Lovett. Heather's credits include roles at 42nd Moon, Broadway by the Bay, Sierra Repertory Theater up in Sonora, as well as participating in Broadway Bingo at the Nico. I hope we'll talk about that. I believe this is your first foray into the role of Mrs. Lovett. Welcome, Heather.
Hi there. Happy to be here. And this is, in fact, my very first foray into Nellie Lovett.
And what a role, a juicy role in so many ways.
In so many ways.
Delectable. Well, there was a revival in 2004 where John Doyle, as director, had the 10-person cast also playing the score, and which, when it returned to Broadway in 2005, garnered another couple of Tonys. A memorable production here in San Francisco in 2015 at the San Francisco Opera with none other than Stephanie Blythe as Mrs. Lovett, who I had the distinct pleasure of talking to about that role. So it's a show that has really become a legend in itself. When did you first get exposed to the amazing Sweeney Todd?
I was very young. I don't remember how old exactly, but I grew up in a very theatrical family. My mother is a dancer and a choreographer, and my dad is a music teacher and a music director. And so I definitely grew up listening to cast recordings, and definitely grew up listening to cast recordings that maybe I was a little too young to be listening to at the time. So I was, you know, the 6-year-old who was running around singing the lyrics to Man of La Mancha and Sweeney Todd and other shows like that. But I actually got to be in Sweeney Todd in high school, not as Mrs. Lovett. We ran out of boys who could sing, and I ended up as Beetle Bamford, which is
fantastic.
A male role. And it was great. I was in, like, full Victorian drag. I had a mustache. It was very exciting for me as a 16-year-old.
Well, and as a 16-year-old performing in something as operatic as Sweeney Todd,
yes,
which really is, it's more than just a revenge show. It's a psychological thriller on so many ways.
I think it's an obsession show.
Obsession show.
More than anything else. You know, I think it's a show that shows what happens when people let obsession take over their minds and hearts, and where that can lead. And spoiler alert, it's nowhere good.
Do you have a favorite interpreter of Mrs. Lovett? Now, of course, there was the memorable film version in 2007 with Tim Burton, Johnny Depp, and Helena Bonham Carter.
Very discriminating with my Lovetts. For me, the gold standard is always Angela Lansbury. I have come to appreciate Patti LuPone's Lovett after much thought and consideration. Yeah, but I mean, really, for me, it is watching that performance of Angela Lansbury in the recording that they made of the touring production.
Well, we don't have, unfortunately, a recording of you singing this, but we can get a glimpse of not only the virtuosity of Mrs. Lovett as interpreted by Angela Lansbury, but what you have to go through as a performer with The Worst Pies in London. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Sure.
From Angela Lansbury, and then more with Heather Orth.
A customer! What you rush, what you hurry? You gave me such a fright, I thought you was a ghost. Half a minute, can't you sit you down, sit. All I meant is that I haven't seen a customer for weeks. Did you come in for a pie, sir? Do forgive me if me head's a little fake. Ugh, what is that? But you think we are the plague? From the way that people keep affording, no you don't. Heaven knows I try, sir. Ugh, but there's no one comes in even to inhale. Right you are, sir, would you like a drop of ale? Mind you, I can't hardly blame them. These are probably the worst pies in London. I know why nobody cares to take them. I should know, I make them, but good now, the worst pies in London. Even that's polite, the worst pies in London. If you doubt it, take a bite. Is that just disgusting? You have to It's nothing but plastic. Here, drink this. You'll need it. The worst pies in London. And no wonder with the price of meat what it is.
The wonderful Angela Lansbury. And what Heather Orth is interpreting in the Heather in the Hillbarn production of Sweeney Todd is saying, that's a tough piece to sing.
It's a tough song. Although, surprisingly, one of the other songs that is perhaps a little less well-known from Sweeney that Mrs. Lovett sings, By the Sea, actually in a lot of ways ends up being harder. I believe I read once that Stephen introduced the song to Angela Lansbury by saying, Angie, I've written you a song where you can't take any breaths. So, and that is correct. It is, in fact, hard to find places to breathe in that song. But it's actually become one of my favorites.
Super, super tune. Mm-hmm. We're going to hear a little bit of Have a Little Priest to go out with shortly. But tell us a little bit about this production directed by Josh Marks.
Absolutely. What excited me about this production, I love Josh. He's an amazing performer as well as a director. And he really wanted to take the story back to the era in which it was originally set. The original Penny Dreadful, called A String of Pearls, that came out in the 1840s, I believe, which was where the character of Sweeney Todd first appeared, was actually set in the late 1700s. Most productions of Sweeney Todd place it in the Victorian era because that's when the story came to prominence. But he decided to take the story back to that late 1700s Georgian Rococo era, which kind of lends this really an interesting aesthetic level to the show, just an added sense of opulence and then also an added sense of decay. Because if the Victorian era was not particularly advanced in terms of hygiene and public cleanliness, the Georgian era was even less so. So it's kind of exciting to see it in a different setting, and a different setting that it doesn't tend to get done in. You tend to see a lot of people who will modernize Sweeney Todd or who will take it in a very stark direction, sort of like in the John Doyle revival. But you don't see it kind of set anywhere besides that or the Victorian era. So it's kind of nice to have that new perspective on it.
And this isn't the John Doyle-esque in terms of your playing instruments as well as singing?
No, my goodness, no. I will neither confirm nor deny that I kind of hate that.
Really? Have you seen any productions that way?
I did. I actually saw the tour with the marvelous Judy Kay as Mrs. Lovett, which was the John Doyle direction. And I didn't like what it did to the score when they had to play their own instruments. We actually have it as a very small theater, and I believe we have 13 or 15 people in the orchestra.
And that's a big pit.
They are in a little loft that is maybe the size of a dining room table, and they said that they have to file in order of instrument because they can't get out once they're all in.
I've been in a set created for and played in Mary Poppins a couple times in an upper little set there.
So tiny. Yeah, but, so tiny.
And so your Sweeney Todd is Keith Pinto. Tell us a little bit about his
work. He is. I love him. I only just got to work with him for the first time last year. We were in Secret Garden at 42nd Street Moon, and we actually played brother and sister. We both are people who are in our 30s and 40s, and we're playing people that were supposed to be in their late teens, early 20s, but that's neither here nor there. And he is just a phenomenal performer. His versatility is incredible. He actually played Toby in a recent production of Sweeney Todd in San Jose within the last year. And to be able to go from playing Toby, the young boy character, to be able to then take on Sweeney Todd, I think is a testament to his versatility as a performer and his skill as a performer, because he's incredible and terrifying in this role. Absolutely terrifying.
Well, Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd have a unique relationship, shall we say the least. Yeah. For those that aren't familiar with the show, give us a little bit more of a synopsis of what happens.
Sure. You know, Sweeney Todd, he enters the show having just escaped really from being a convict who was sent to Australia by a corrupt judge. And he comes back to London and goes back to the place where he was living and encounters Mrs. Lovett, who had a pie shop underneath his barber shop. And she was actually fairly obsessed with him during her life, very sort of covetous of him and his relationship with his wife. And she sees this as fate having dropped him back into her lap.
An opportunity,
if you will. So she sees this as a grand romance. This is for her, it's a romantic comedy, show.
That's the aforementioned By the Sea, where she imagines this life together up
absolutely
in Brighton, I believe.
Yeah.
By the Sea.
By the Sea. And, you know, he, on the other hand, is completely solely focused on getting revenge on this corrupt judge for taking his wife and taking his daughter away from him and sending him off just so that he could sort of usurp his place in his family. And it's where their roads of obsession lead them.
Could you give us a snippet of By the Sea, just Acapulco, as they say?
Oh, let's see. By the sea, Mr. Todd, that's the life I carve it. By the sea, Mr. Todd, ooh, I know you'd love it. You and me, Mr. T, we could be alone in an house what we'd almost own down by the sea.
With the fishies splashing.
With the fishies splashing.
Very nice. Thank you for that. Wow. Now I'm totally enticed to see the Hillbarn production with you and with Keith Pinto, as directed by Josh Marks. Sweeney Todd runs through February 10th at the award-winning place, Hillbarn Theater. Hillbarn is down on the peninsula. Hillbarn Theater with an re.org for more information. You will be thrilled, shall we say.
Oh, you will.
In this one.
Definitely.
Let's hear the aforementioned Angela Lansbury with Len Carreyrou when Mrs. Lovett has this great idea.
Such a good idea.
An awful waste. I mean, with the price of meat, what it is, when you get it, if you get it.
Ha!
Good, you got it. Take, for instance, Mrs. Mooney and a pie shop. Business never better using ugly pussycats and toast. And a pussy's good for maybe 6 or 7 at the most. And I'm sure they can't compare as far as taste.
Mrs. Lovett, what a charming notion.
Well,
and a happy practical and appropriate as always. Mrs. Lovett, how I've lived without you all these years, I'll never know.
Think about it, lots of other gentlemen will soon be cannon for a shame. Won't they think of
choice
all their
past? Oh, what's the sound of the world out there?
What, Mr. Todd, what, Mr. Todd, what is that sound?
Those crunching noises pervading the air.
Yes, Mr. Todd, yes, all around.
It's man devouring man, my dear.
And who are we to deny it in here?
Ah, these are desperate times, Mrs. Lovett. And desperate measures must be taken.
Here we are now, hot out of the oven.
What is that?
It's priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh. So it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
No, you see, the trouble with poet is how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
Heavenly. Not as hearty as bishop, perhaps, but then not as bland as curate, either.
Good for business, too. Always leaves you wanting more. Trouble is, we only get it on Sundays. Lawyer's rather nice.
If it's for a price.
Order something else, though, to follow, since no one should swallow it twice.
Have you any dean?
No, but if you're British and loyal, you might enjoy Royal Marine. Anyway, it's clean, though of course it tastes of wherever it's been.
Is that squire on the fire?
Macinosa, look closer, you'll notice it's grosser.
Looks thicker, more like thicker.
No, it has to be grosser, it's green.
The history of the world, my love.
Save a lot of graves, do a lot of relatives' favors.
Is those below serving those up above?
Everybody shaves, so there should be plenty of flavors.
How gratifying for once to know
that those above will serve those down below. Now let me see. We've got Tinker.
No. Something pinker.
Taylor.
Paler.
Butler.
Sutler.
Potter.
Hotter.
Locksmith. Lovely bit of clock.
Maybe for a lark.
Then again, the sweep, if you want it cheap and you like it dark. Try the financier, pick up his career.
That looks pretty rank.
Well, he drank, it's a bank cashier. Last one really sold, wasn't quite so old.
Have you any beetle?
Next week, so I'm told. Beetle isn't bad till you smell it and notice how well it's been greased. Stick to priest. Now, this might be a bit stringy, but then, of course, it's a fiddle player.
No, no, this isn't fiddle player. It's piccolo player.
How can you tell?
It's piping hot.
Then blow on it first.
And with that note from piccolo player to piccolo player slash announcer, we're back here on Open Air. The Demon Barber of Fleet Street is at the Hill Barn Theater through February 10th. Hill Barn Theater, theaterwithanre.org for more information. To the legitimate stage we go with TheaterWorks Silicon Valley that kicks off the new year with the Tony and Olivier Award-winning drama Frost Nixon, written by Golden Globe winner Peter Morgan, the creator of Netflix The Crown. Frost Nixon tells a story that led to the legendary series of TV interviews that ultimately determined President Nixon's legacy. The show debuted in London in 2006 to critical acclaim, later securing 3 Olivier Award nominations, including Best New Play. Its 2007 Broadway premiere garnered a slew of awards, including a Tony Drama Desk and Outer Critics Circle Award for actor Frank Langella for his performance as Nixon, later portraying it on film, directed by Ron Howard and nominated for some 5 Academy Awards and Golden Globes. TheaterWorks has assembled a stellar cast for this production, featuring Jeremy Webb as British talk show host David Frost and Alan McCullough as former President Nixon, both making their TheaterWorks debuts. Jeremy's credits include Lincoln Center Theater, the Old Globe, Long Wharf Theater, Hartford Stage, among many others, and has been seen in roles on NBC's Law & Order franchise, as well as on Guiding Light. Welcome to you, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you?
Happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Alan McCullough has been seen in HBO's Vinyl, directed by Martin Scorsese, and in Amazon Prime Video's Marvelous, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. He's also appeared on stage in Roundabout Theatre's company's national tour of 12 Angry Men, and in productions by Long Wharf Theatre, Baltimore Center Stage, and the Folger Theatre. Jeremy Webb, Alan McCullough, welcome to you as well.
Thanks.
Confuse you both.
Nice,
yes,
to be here.
Indeed. Well, Alan, let's start with you. It must be both a challenge and great fun to portray such a historical and histrionic figure as Richard Milhouse Nixon.
It's a bit of a challenge. It's been a pleasure, a terrifying pleasure. Let's put it that way. I don't even know where to begin talking about this man. I am old enough to remember Mr. Nixon. I was a teenager when he resigned and was thrilled when that happened.
Ditto.
And as I said to our talkback audience last night, I lived in Massachusetts at the time, and we, you know, in the second his second election, we got it right. Even California didn't get it right at that point. Mm. We voted against him. But he's a very complicated fellow, and it's interesting to try to find a path by which to bring him to life without lapsing into parody, because everybody has the Richard Nixon rubber mask, and they know what that.
Of course, they do.
They know what that is, and they know the V for Victory and all that. And so, I've struggled mightily in my own craft work to try to walk a fine line
and figure out. Checkers involved in the production?
No, there is no checkers involved, and it's all post. You know, I mean, it's way post Watergate.
Right,
it's way after
right.
it all. And it really is the story about how he and Frost come together as men and have a meeting of the minds and sort of a meeting of the hearts in a way as well. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, it's really a play about how Frost works as a snake charmer to get him to, mm-hmm. Or a therapist, or to get Nixon to, in fact, reveal sort of the more core self, which Nixon was not very good at doing.
Mm. Jeremy Webb, growing up also during the Nixon administration and its downfall, my only recollection of David Frost was through these interviews and his rather severe interview style. And through this production, we learned that he was really pretty much a lightweight figure in his native England.
Yes and no. Lightweight, sure. I mean, I think it's fair to say that Frost used these interviews as an opportunity, as a transformational opportunity, perhaps, as many people who've spent long swaths of time in politics or show business do, you know, the power of transformation. I mean, he had a very popular sort of satiric show in the late 60s called This Is the Week That Was. The night that the moon landing happened in 1969, he had a 10-hour broadcast called David Frost's Moon Party where they mixed cocktails and danced, and he did lightweight interviews. But, you know, this is also a guy who interviewed 6 consecutive British prime ministers and 7 consecutive U.S. presidents. Won many, many awards for his hard-hitting journalism. Good, bad, or indifferent, he was the only journalist that President George Bush would talk to about his strategy during the Iraq War. The last person to land a serious interview with Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, right before she was assassinated when she returned to Pakistan. So, you
transformational,
know,
sure.
Yeah, he was both. He was both. Mm-hmm. He was both things. And as Alan articulated, they were both on some sort of parallel tracks during this period of the mid-70s and not using each other, but they came together in a mutually exclusive moment that was sort of worked in different ways for both of them.
Right. From what I understand from and having watched the amazing movie with Frank Langella portraying Nixon, there's hesitation on both sides for even thinking of such a series of interviews. Tell us a bit about how they were set up and the expectations and maybe demands of both parties. You can take your turns on that one, Jeremy first, as David.
Sure. Well, so there's this idea in America that checkbook journalism is a faux pas, and that's the idea of paying for an interview. But, you know, in the British press and with the British tabloids and certainly the history and the tradition of Richard Murdoch, who took over that Sun newspaper in 1969, I mean, he sort of transformed journalism in this way where it was no major thing to pay for an interview. So in that sense, Frost, in the 70s, right as Nixon is leaving the White House, starts to reach out between their agents and their press representatives to say, you know, I'd really like to do these series of hard-hitting interviews with you, or puff piece interviews, whatever you're interested in, and I'm willing to pay for them. And in fact, that's exactly what happens. Nixon leaves the White House rather broke, and in need of remuneration.
A job.
with legal bills and Frost. So there's an ask and answer going on there between mm-hmm. between the two men and the money that's provided.
And so what about on Nixon's part? What was Nixon hoping to get other than securing his legacy as something other than a disgraced president?
I think that was the major thing he was really after, was trying to frame his legacy in his own words, because he had no control over that. Watergate had certainly smeared his reputation in all ways, in all forms and all medias. And I think he saw this as a way to put the record straight, as he says it, to tell it from his own point of view, and particularly talk to his strengths and about his strengths. And if you watch the tapes, which both Jeremy and I have done as part of our research, Alan, the actor, was fascinated and informed by his talk, particularly about foreign policy. There's a whole segment on foreign policy, which is astonishing, absolutely astonishing. The man was brilliant in foreign policy. There's just no way around it, and he kept the world in a major way from, you know, coming to blows with itself in all kinds of ways. Dealing with Russia and dealing in the Middle East, and you know, he did extraordinary things. And I think he really wanted to remind people, "Hey, guys, you know, I did other things. I did make a mistake. Watergate was a huge mistake, but I did a lot of other things that were important for the country and important for the world. And $600,000 came in handy.
I didn't know what the price tag was. Wow! And to his credit, David Frost didn't just let Nixon run the show.
No, he did it for a while, but no, he didn't. He elicited the closest thing to contrition for what Nixon put the country through that anyone ever got out of Richard Nixon. And I've come to the understanding through spending the time with the role and in the material that he did so by establishing a relationship and trust with the man. And yes, he does end up not letting Nixon off the hook and asking hard-hitting questions and even coming up with gotcha information that never came up in any of the congressional hearings or with the Irvin Committee, but always treats the president with respect. And with an opportunity to explain himself.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. And we've talked a lot in rehearsal about how the fact that he was British, that Frost was British and not an American and had never voted for Nixon and didn't have a political agenda.
Had never voted.
Had never voted, was really important in this way. And I think Nixon clearly respected Frost and how he went about his work and the research that he'd done. And in the tapes, he even says, you know my life better than anybody but myself. And he was admiring of that. And the fact that Frost did not attack Nixon in any way and was really looking for the inner man, I think, was, allowed Nixon, and who wanted in some way to come to confession.
I think Alan brings up a really interesting point, and that is that the being from across the pond nature of it really helped, because there was no personal vendetta. Americans, where there are several characters in the play, including Jim Reston, who's played by the actor Kenny Toll, who has a counterculture 60s and 70s anti-war, anti-Vietnam, anti-Nixon agenda, which is strong, and which we all know. We've all know these people. Many people that I know felt that strongly about Nixon. Frost didn't have that. He had an across the pond sort of awareness of Nixon that goes to that idea of objective journalism, I think.
And a curiosity about what makes people tick. I think that was true of Frost generally. He was more interested in why are you the way you are than why have you done what you've done.
Interesting.
And I think that comes through the play.
Hmm. Direction is by Leslie Martinson, the TheatreWorks former award-winning associate artistic director who's been associated with TheatreWorks in various capacities for some 30 years. What is Leslie bringing to the production?
Oh, my God.
Everything.
Oh, my
she's
God.
Unbelievable. She's
fantastic.
First of all, she cast us.
Yeah. So right
good
there.
Save. Good save there.
She was so prepared. I mean, she's been working on the history of this play and Watergate and Nixon and Frost for over a year. And we walked into this room. I had done some research, but the stuff that she provided as a possibility, not as a necessity in any way, was fantastic. She's also an enormously smart woman, and speaks a series of theatrical languages. And she can talk to actors. She can talk about the play. She can talk about what the play says to the audience. She can talk about storytelling. She can talk about the technical situation of producing and presenting the work in a particular way. Mm.
And a couple of my favorite qualities, it's a very the best idea wins room. It's not, it doesn't have to be her idea. It doesn't have to be my idea.
Mm. That's to her credit.
Everyone down to the stage management staff on this show had buy-in about, what works and what wins.
Mm.
It's an ego-free environment, which I love. It's not about, featuring some particular actor's ego. It's about storytelling.
Yeah.
I could go on and on about Leslie.
She just loved her work.
Terrific. Well, we're going to go out with some of the groovy 60s-style music that served as
baby.
A theme to the David Frost Show. Thank you to Jeremy Webb and to Alan McCullough for Frost and Nixon.
Thank you so much.
We look forward to the production at Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. Information at TheatreWorks. Again, theater with an R-E. Tossed to the Brits there, I guess. TheatreWorks.org. The show runs through February 10th. Gentlemen, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for
having
so
much.
Us.
Raw Dance, the award-winning contemporary dance company, is celebrating its 15th anniversary season with three works, apropos for these uncertain times, that also reflect back historically with the hope that a lesson is learned for the future. Performances are tonight, Friday, and Saturday evenings at the Yerba Buena Center Forum on Mission Street here in San Francisco. Earlier this week, I caught up with, by phone, to the two co-artistic directors, and acclaimed and accomplished dancers and choreographers to boot, Wendy Rhine and Ryan T. Smith, along with Associate Director Katie Wong, to talk about the program. Wendy, Ryan, Katie, welcome to KLW's Open Air.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. Three of us will have to see how this goes in terms of choreography over the phone. Well, let's start with Wendy and Ryan. One of the two world premieres on the program is your work called Roar, which I gather refers back to the Roaring Twenties.
That is correct. It's inspired by some of the glitz and glam of the 1920s, and more specifically, the veneer of the glitz and glam of the 1920s. We're looking at that period of history as kind of a parallel to today, and kind of the underbelly, the darker side of the 1920s, some of the lessons that we might learn for our political climate now.
It's also been kind of a fun venture for us in that it is such an iconic visual world, and there's so much choreography that's built into that era. So it's been really fun for us to explore that side while also really taking the opportunity to look at some of the parallels to what we're dealing with today.
What will we see on stage?
You'll see some gold, lots and lots of gold. You'll see a few Charlestons here and there because we just couldn't resist. It's also actually a very theatrical work, so there is a little bit of live singing. There's some live text. We pull in a few jokes from the old vaudeville performer Ed Lowery from the 20s and 30s. There's actually a 1928 track from the Chicago Rhythm Kings. There'll be some changes made and a new interpretation by our composer, Joel St. Julien. It's a really fun, I think, full production. It is true to the times of the Roaring Twenties. It is a show.
That, and it's a cast of six people. There are five women and Ryan and one man, which also took us down the path of really exploring the feminist movement that was happening in the 20s and that we see even more echoed amplification of today.
We'll hear a little bit of that original score by Bay Area composer Joel St. Julien before we finish our interview. We'll hear an excerpt from that shortly. There's a very provocative picture on the rawdance.org website that I encourage folks to take a look at that kind of epitomizes that kind of dichotomy of golden age of radio. Is that fair to say?
No,
absolutely.
It's true. We take our imagery very seriously, and it's also very fun. And I think that image for us captures that fantastic, glittery, Great Gatsby side of the 20s, but also really clarifies our piece in the way that there is something off. There is the veneer of the glitz and glam, and there's something beneath the surface of that gold.
Interesting. It should be fascinating to watch then. You're also reprising Brilliant Alarm from 2017. For those that missed it back then, why don't you tell us about it?
Yes. Brilliant Alarm was originally commissioned actually by YBCA for their inaugural Transform Fest in 2017. And the original question behind that festival was, why citizenship? And so we took that to really be, what does it take to be an informed citizen, and what does that mean? And so we started looking at cycles of anti-intellectualism in recent global history. We were creating this pretty much right after the 2016 presidential election, and there had been just such bashing of intellectuals in our own country, and it really resonated with us as what it took to be an informed citizen and what that meant and what different choices one might make with different information.
And I think Brilliant Alarm for us was the start of this suite of works that comprise our 15th anniversary season, in that we turned to the past, we looked at these historical examples of the cycles of anti-intellectualism as parallels to today, and start to realize, okay, this is a cycle. This is stuff that we've seen before. We can learn from this. We will also get through this. And I really feel like that's something that we carried through all three of the works in this program.
Well, it certainly resonates with this time, especially. It's very pertinent. Again, what will
we? Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. Well, again, what will we see on stage?
lots and lots and lots of blue books. For this set, given that we were talking a lot about education and intellectualism, we actually have 200 blue books that are manipulated and transformed throughout this space. It is a work for
six dancers.
I had to think about that for a moment. six dancers to an original score by a Bay Area choreography composer, Sarabi Saraf.
And actually, just as a shout out, all three works on the program have set design by Chad Owens and lighting design by Alan Wilner. So they've created three very, very distinct worlds for all three of the pieces.
And incredible accolades for them for their past work as well. That's Wendy...
Oh, we're so lucky to work with them.
Ryan Smith and Wendy Ryan, co-creators of these works as part of Raw Dance 15th anniversary. Katie Wong, you're kind of the new kid on the block with this company, though you've been working with them since 2004. Has your tenure with Raw Dance helped influence how you approached your contribution to the program, 14, which will also enjoy
Absolutely.
Its world premiere?
I think a lot of the time that we've had to spend together as collaborators on their past works has informed a lot of my decision-making around content, but also around structure and aesthetic choices, as well as how we sort of create in the process of making the work. So a lot of it is collaborative. We had a lot of great conversations with the dancers and performers, as well as with the lighting and scenic designers. And so it's really everyone's hands in the mix to create this piece together. And I think a lot of that has been influenced by the experiences I've had working with Ryan and Wendy in the past.
14 refers to the 14th Amendment. Let's have a little brief history refresher course, if we will.
Yeah, absolutely. So the 14th Amendment has the equal protection of the law clause as well as due process. And it also is the amendment that cites citizenship as happening if you are born or naturalized in the United States. So at the base of many of our civil rights progress in our society over the last decades, from integration to segregation to marriage equality, interracial marriage, women's rights to equal pay, and so many more things. You know, due process has a lot of connections to what we're seeing with movements right now, like Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement. And so there are a lot of baseline issues that are focused on the 14th Amendment.
Very timely indeed for this show, Katie Wong. Tell us again, what will we actually see? How many dancers are involved in your work?
There will be five dancers, including myself, so two women and three men, and we will all be performing underneath a scenic design by Chad Owens, which will be a beautiful representation of sort of the text and the historical document of the Constitution, but in his own artistic interpretation, and in a way that the dancers can also be incorporated in and in interact with.
Manipulate.
Exactly, yeah.
Katie's piece also has a wonderful sound score that she's been collaging with a lot of found sound from various media sources and news clips and blogs and podcasts, you name it.
Including NPR.
Exactly. You might be on there, David.
Who knows?
Those are our secrets. But it really helps contextualize the work and show the depth of the 14th Amendment and how interwoven it is to all of these important current issues.
Mm-hmm. Katie Wong, choreographer for 14. Also, Wendy Ryan and Ryan Smith, co-artistic directors of Raw Dance, and presenting their Brilliant Alarm from 2017, as well as the world premiere of Roar. Those performances tonight, Friday and Saturday evenings at the Yerba Buena Center here in San Francisco on Mission Street. Wendy, Ryan, Katie, thanks so much for taking a little bit of time with me. I'm glad this finally worked out.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. You can learn more about these performances at rawdance.org. By the way, Raw Dance will also be participating for the inaugural San Francisco edition of the Night of Ideas on February 2nd at the library's main branch on Larkin Street. For this special event, the library, SF MoMA, and the French Consulate in San Francisco unite to present a 7-hour marathon of debate, performance, reading, screenings, music, and dance, including performances by Raw Dance. It's free and open to all. The marathon will feature top thinkers from San Francisco and beyond to spur the dialogue on the theme, Facing Our Time, the City of the Future. Visit rawdance.org for their full calendar of events. And now, as promised, a little touch of Bay Area composer Joel St. Julian's soundtrack for Roar. A slightly darker variation on There'll Be Some Changes Made. And that's Open Air for this Thursday, January 24th. Our shows are archived at klw.org. News from the BBC is up after this NPR update.